I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. President Donald Trump's nomination of another conservative jurist to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court is keeping the issue of abortion access in this country on the front burner. Today, we'll look at the state of reproductive rights in Missouri and Kansas. What steps have legislators already taken to restrict access, and what could happen should Roe v. Wade be modified or even overturned? Then we'll check in with one of the nation's top urban planners. He's been keeping an eye on Kansas City this year, and he'll give us his takeaways. We'll learn why taking a neighborhood's first approach to development can benefit the entire city. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. President Trump's nomination of another conservative jurist to the U.S. Supreme Court has taken the issue of abortion and tossed it up into the air all over again. Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh has indicated that he regards the landmark Roe v. Wade abortion ruling as settled law, but what that means exactly is unclear. A ruling to overturn or weaken Roe could result in each of the 50 states dealing with the issue anew. Exactly what that could mean for Kansas and Missouri might surprise you. With us to talk about the road ahead for the always intensely controversial issue of abortion are Dan Margulies. He's the health editor at KCUR. Dan, good morning.
Morning, Steve.
Maddie Fox is with the Kansas News Service based here at KCUR. Maddie, welcome back.
Thank you.
Dan, it seemed like all was calm on the abortion front until President Trump came along and nominated Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now it seems like everything is up in the air, as I said. Does that sound right to you?
Well, I would not say that everything was calm before Kavanaugh was nominated. Certainly not in Missouri and certainly not in Kansas. I'll let Maddie speak to Kansas, but in Missouri, it's been a hotbed of litigation over the various abortion restrictions that the state continues to impose to make it more difficult to access abortion services. And we have right now in Missouri any number, I count about half a dozen pending cases at both the federal district court level and the federal appeals court level pending challenges to various restrictions that Missouri has enacted. And, of course, if Roe v. Wade is explicitly overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court in the future, Missouri is one of the states that is ready to spring into action because then abortion regulation will revert back to the states, as was the case pre-Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are four states, Missouri is not among them, nor is Kansas, there are four states that have laws on the books that, in the event Roe v. Wade is overturned, abortion will be banned outright in those states. Missouri hasn't quite approached that level, but it has certainly shown its willingness to enact all kinds of restrictions, including one that didn't make it out of the legislature this year but will come up again, namely banning abortion after 20 weeks.
Maddie, the lay of the land on when it comes to abortion in Kansas would be what?
Well, we have a lot of abortion restrictions as well. There's a 24-hour waiting period. There's only four abortion clinics in Kansas, in Wichita and Overland Park. If you're living in western Kansas or between those two, it's a bit of a trek for you to get an abortion. We also have parental consent. Minors have to get parental consent from, I believe, both parents in order to get an abortion procedure. And as became kind of a lightning rod issue during this year's legislative session, you cannot get an abortion through telemedicine. One of the more common procedures is a medication abortion. So you'd take a combination of two pills. And that's been done by telemedicine in some places. So done where you're like Skyping with a doctor, and Kansas was very much like, absolutely not here. So.
Maddie, you just did a piece on the abortion wars in Kansas going back a number of years. Give us a quick history lesson here, because you have to go all the way back to 1991 and what was called the Summer of Love in Wichita to get a feel for this issue's trajectory in Kansas.
It's actually the Summer of Mercy, I believe.
Summer of
Summer
Mercy.
Summer of Love was
San Francisco.
Was
Stockholm.
Oh, excuse me,
am I getting my summers mixed up?
Wow. But yes, in 1991, there were actually three abortion clinics in Wichita alone, and one of them was run by Dr. George Tiller, who that might be a name some people recognize. He was doing a very late-stage abortion, so into the third trimester, and he was one of very few doctors doing that at the time. There's still even fewer doctors in the country doing late-stage abortions. And so that attracted the attention of a group called Operation Rescue, who had done a lot of religiously-based protests against abortion and against abortion providers. So they came to Wichita and in I want to say July of 91. It might have been June, now that I think about it. But and the clinics in Wichita decided, okay, we're just going to shut down for a week and wait this out. That'll be fine. And the people from Operation Rescue who had come in for these protests were like, oh my gosh, success. And so they decided to dig their heels in and stay in Wichita as long as they could. And it became quite a scene. You had police taking protesters off. You had protesters taking such small baby steps in accordance with police orders to move that it actually took them hours and hours to leave the parking lot of where they were protesting. So it's really something.
The anti-abortion crowd then sort of wound up altering state politics in Kansas in a very substantial way. How would you describe it?
Well, one of the smarter things that protesters did that summer was really try to turn it into long-term political action. While there were people protesting, there were people also, you know, signing people up for precinct committee positions. So that would be like the most local level of politics. And then from there, they could build into challenging some more moderate, usually Republicans in the state legislature and getting people into office that who would pass some of these abortion restrictions that we have. Because those ones that I listed just a couple minutes ago, you know, the waiting periods, the parental consent, those did not exist in 91. There were not a lot of restrictions on abortion in 91. And because of the activism that came out of the summer of 91 and then the way that they protesters managed to put that into political action and get people into the legislature means that we have a very, very different landscape for abortion in this state than we did.
You know, Dan Margulies, you've already described the ongoing legal fights in Missouri over this procedure, but I think it's fair to say that Missouri hasn't been as high profile on the abortion issue as Kansas has been over the years in terms of headlines. Why is that?
I think it's happenstance. I think it could well have been just as big a hotspot as Kansas, but for the fact that the folks that Matty is describing right now chose Kansas precisely because George Tiller, who, you know, was later killed, was doing late-stage abortions, as Matty said, and so they decided to put their focus on Wichita. But it could just as easily have been Missouri.
Yeah. You know, to what extent, Dan, then have the number of abortions in both states dropped over the years? Do you have any sense of that?
I wasn't prepared to answer that. I know that in 2014 or so, the number of abortions provided in Missouri for both residents and out-of-state residents, because some people come from out-of-state to secure abortions here, numbered somewhat over 5,000. I'd have to go back and look, but the irony, of course, is that by imposing all these restrictions, not just on abortion, but on the ability of women to obtain contraceptives and to do birth control, engage in birth control, something that Planned Parenthood provides in addition to abortions, the same people who purport to be against abortions are causing more abortions, if you will, to happen.
Yeah,
because they're making it more difficult for women to control their own bodies.
You know, I'm assuming, Matty, that a lot of our listeners out there would say that if Roe winds up getting overturned, then the procedure is doomed in both of our states. But you point to a big wrinkle to that way of thinking in Kansas, which has to do with a big abortion case that's now before the Kansas Supreme Court. What is that case?
Well, I might have to have Dan back me up on this a little, but there was the legislature passed a ban on dilation and evacuation abortions, which is the more common second trimester procedure.
And that got challenged in court by an abortion provider, and I believe her father, in Overland Park. And that case has made it all the way up to the state Supreme Court. Now, depending on how they rule, the Kansas Supreme Court might find that Kansas has a right to abortion in the Constitution under the right to privacy, which is also what Roe is under at the federal level. So if they do that, if they find that there is a right to abortion in the Kansas Constitution, it doesn't matter what happens with Roe, because our state constitution would say, yes, you can get one of these. Now, what restrictions that allows is, you know, always going to be a little bit up for debate. But yeah, and that case it's been heard. It's not yet been decided. We've been waiting on that decision for a while now.
A long, long time. Yes, that case has been before the Kansas Supreme Court for, I believe, more than a year. It was argued many months ago. And clearly the court, given the fraught nature of this case, is going to take its sweet time about deciding it, because whichever way it comes out on this case, it's going to be one of the most significant and important decisions that the court has made in a long time.
Well, Dan, let's talk about that. So if the judges on the Kansas Supreme Court then determine that the state constitution guarantees a right to an abortion, what will that mean? I mean, what happens to all those restrictive laws that Maddie just described, aimed at making access to abortion all the more difficult?
Right. Well, as Maddie correctly said, the first thing to note is that if the Kansas Supreme Court finds the right of abortion enshrined in the Kansas Constitution's Bill of Rights under its due process clause, then no matter what happens with Roe v. Wade, whether it's even if it's overturned, Kansas residents will have a right to abortion under the Kansas Constitution, as opposed to the federal Constitution, which the U.S. Supreme Court will be ruling on. That said, that doesn't mean that the state wouldn't be able to enact various restrictions. It all depends on how the Kansas Supreme Court comes down with its ruling. And, you know, it won't, of course, be the end of the matter, as we've seen with Roe v. Wade. On the contrary, that case represented the start of a huge mountain of litigation that has ensued in the subsequent decades since that case was decided. Likewise, in Kansas, once the Kansas Supreme Court makes its decision, even if it finds that the Kansas Constitution codifies the right to abortion, there'll be restrictions enacted, and the court will eventually have to decide whether those restrictions come within the ambit of its constitutional ruling.
Hey, Maddie, I think you've also reported that if the court rules there is a right to abortion in Kansas, there will be a counter effort then mounted to pass a constitutional amendment that would flip that.
You read my mind. I was just about to talk about that. So,
yeah.
Yes. Governor Collier, very early on when he took over office after Brownback left, expressed in a speech, and I cannot remember for the life of me which one it was, his support for a constitutional amendment. Chris Kobach, the Republican candidate for governor, has also expressed his support for a constitutional amendment. So this idea that if the Kansas Constitution finds that, yes, there's a right to abortion under the if the Supreme Court finds that, yes, there's a right to abortion in the Kansas Constitution, then we're going to change the Constitution. And that would be quite a task.
I was going to say, it's tough to do that, right?
Yes, indeed. They would need a two-thirds majority of the legislature to move this forward before they even take it to the Kansas population as a whole. And that is where, you know, these efforts to fill the legislature with anti-abortion lawmakers, that's kind of where the rubber's going to meet the road there. And then, of course, you know, it goes to the people, and that's it's a big hurdle to clear to amend the Constitution, which, you know, makes sense. It's supposed to be a pretty binding document.
Yeah. Dan, on the Missouri side, what would you anticipate if Kavanaugh joins the court and strikes down Roe?
Well, I actually don't think that if Kavanaugh is confirmed to the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court will out and out reverse Roe. I think what we'll witness is perhaps the death of Roe by 1,000 cuts. The court will be increasingly supportive of abortion restrictions of the kind that Missouri and Kansas have enacted. And so I think Missouri will continue, if Kavanaugh is confirmed, as I anticipate he will be, It will continue to impose restrictions, including yet another attempt to ban abortion outright after 20 weeks, or maybe even lower that age threshold. You remember Roe v. Wade says that states cannot ban abortion during the pre-viability stage of a fetus or embryo. And that viability stage, because of scientific and medical advances, has decreased over the years since Roe was decided in 1973. So I think you're going to see further attempts to limit abortion in Missouri by banning it after a certain weeks-long threshold.
But as you know, Dan, Judge Kavanaugh made headlines this week because he came out and said that he regards abortion and he regards Roe versus Wade to be settled law. There's quotes around that phrase, settled law.
Right.
What does that mean to you?
Right. Well, you know, that's a very artfully chosen phrase, which I think he is trying to reassure those people who believe that he is going to overturn it. But saying that it's settled law doesn't really tell us much because the Supreme Court, of course, is free to overturn any of its precedents. Now, supposedly, the court doesn't want to do that all too often because then there's no certainty in the law and because if they can just overturn decisions they've made seemingly on a whim, then, you know, that causes an erosion of respect for what the court does. As I say, I don't really think the court will out and out reverse Roe v. Wade, but I think it will be increasingly receptive to the kinds of restrictions that have been enacted in Missouri and Kansas.
Maddie, do you happen to know off the top of your head what national polls say these days about the attitude of the American people toward access to abortion?
I could not tell you specifically, unfortunately. I will say that one thing that surprised a lot of people is the opposition to abortion has stayed pretty consistent. We've seen a lot of changes in other more liberal social ideas. I mean, we've seen a broader acceptance of gay marriage. We've seen a broader acceptance of all sorts of things. But abortion is kind of, the dial hasn't moved a whole lot. And that has been surprising to people because it's still, and anti-abortion stances are still very popular, even among young people, yeah, among all the demographics. So it's a persistent issue. I mean, we're going to see it. It looks like we're going to see it as a wedge issue for a long time.
Dan, back on the Missouri side of the state line, Kansas City's Midtown Planned Parenthood Clinic has been operating without a license to perform abortions for several weeks. What's that about?
Well, that's an interesting case. That facility, of course, is just a block from where we are sitting here today, Steve.
Yes.
And they are licensed to perform medication abortions, the kind of abortions that Maddie was talking about a little earlier. And they have to have that abortion license renewed every year. So when the state of Missouri sent its inspectors to do its annual inspection prior to granting its license, it so happened that the clinic had lost its sole abortion provider. And on that basis, the state said that it wouldn't be able to renew the license until such time as it had one on the premises. And then it said that it would have to start the inspection process all over from scratch, further delaying the possibility of getting a license. I did a story about this, I think it was 3 weeks or so ago, and whether it was the reaction to the story saying that the Midtown Clinic had lost its license to perform Medicaid abortions or some other factor. A week later, the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services, which oversees abortion facilities, all of a sudden seemed to reverse course and said that, well, now that they do have an abortion provider and they did secure one, they expect to grant the license. So I'm expecting that to happen any day now.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Dan Margulies, health editor at KCUR, Maddie Fox with the Kansas News Service based here at KCUR. Thank you both very much. Sure appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll discuss how Kansas City could become an even greater city. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, why some residents in Northeast Kansas City and law enforcement officers are fed up with the scrap metal industry. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, the opioid crisis may be dominating the headlines, but meth use in Missouri continues to worsen. We'll talk about the state of the epidemic and how the industry has morphed from mom-and-pop labs to an international operation. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, nationally renowned urban thinker Chuck Marone is coming back to town. In January, Chuck helped kick off the Kansas City Public Library's Making a Great City series. On Tuesday, he returns to Kansas City to assess the crucial takeaways from all three sessions, including the advisability of an incremental neighborhoods first approach to development. He's also an advocate of establishing a land use and transportation pattern that produces enough long-term revenue to build resilient, self-sustaining cities. Too many cities, he says, simply cannot afford to maintain the infrastructures they have. Chuck Marone is a professor, a professional engineer, and a member of the American Institute of Certified Planners. He's the founder and president of Strong Towns, a group that supports development that allows America's cities, towns, and neighborhoods to become financially resilient. He joins us by Skype from his office. And Chuck, good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Let's talk about the library's Making a Great City series. What are some of the takeaways you point to as they apply to Kansas City, Chuck?
Yeah, I think the series has been fantastic. And I know a couple of the other speakers, and they've done a really wonderful job communicating this notion that, you know, it's one thing to grow and to build a city. It's another thing to sustain it over time. I think after World War II, we became really good kind of in response to some of the things we had experienced during the Great Depression. We became very good at growing. We figured out how to juice our economy, how to get things happening, how to build new stuff. Now we're a little long in the tooth on that, and we're sitting back looking at all the stuff we've built in Kansas City, all these miles of roads and sidewalks and pipe, all the big buildings and things that, you know, when we had the ribbon cutting for them felt really good. But now we're looking at this stuff going, how do we maintain all this? Mm-hmm. And when we actually look at our tax base, what we see is that, you know, that tax base that was produced from all this public investment just isn't up to the task financially of maintaining all that stuff. So we've got some big questions ahead of us. How do we deal with that? How do we make better use of the stuff we've already created? And I think this series has done a good job of highlighting that.
Well, I guess, you know, how do we deal with that? Because people still would like to see us build and grow as opposed to emphasize maintaining what we have.
No doubt. And I think at the end of the day, this can't just be a maintenance conversation. Otherwise, we're going to be in a lot of hurt. This is part of the shift that we need to make.
And why can't it be a maintenance conversation?
Because you cannot squeeze, $2 of wealth out of a $1 turnip, or what I do, the old adage, you can't squeeze blood out of a rock or what have you. There's only so much wealth there, and we actually have more stuff that we need to fix than we can afford to pay for. Mm. And so in this scenario we are now, if we don't do anything differently, and even if we just switch to maintenance, a lot of it's not going to be maintained. I mean, a lot of the roads we have are not going to be fixed. A lot of the pipes we have are never going to be replaced. There's just not enough wealth there to do it all. So if we go that route, you're really talking triage, you know, what gets fixed and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. That was the conversation Detroit had for years, and it didn't end well for them. Kansas City is a couple decades behind Detroit, but it's essentially the same development model, the same trajectory. So we have to have a different conversation here.
Well, you're making me nervous. So what are some options that might be on the table then?
Well, I think the question is, how do we take a block in the city of Kansas City, look at what's there now, go in and do a project where at the end of it, there's more there. In a very simple sense, you've got a block with four homes. How do we end up with a block with eight homes? That's uncomfortable to some people because they don't like to see that kind of change and that kind of growth. They're uncomfortable with what that would mean. I think the challenge we've got is, how do we get past that discomfort? Because from a math standpoint, That's what needs to happen.
Are you suggesting that we need to shrink, Chuck, that we're too spread out here? We're known for being so spread out here in the Midwest. Is that our issue or one of our big issues?
I don't think that the idea of consciously going out to try to shrink is maybe the best way to think about it. I think Kansas City, like most Midwestern cities, is going to shrink over the next two decades, whether we really want to or not. Like I said, when you've built so much road that you don't have the money to fix them all, some of them won't be fixed. And that's going to mean a different development pattern, a different place where the private capital is being invested. You can already see the shift taking place. A lot of the energy you've had out on the far periphery has started to kind of dry up or go into very small pockets. And there's been a lot of shift of that private capital to areas that have a lot more vitality, the downtown being kind of first and foremost among them. If you follow that shift out for decades and you say, well, where is this going to end up? You can see in some of the neighborhoods that are, you know, built in the 50s and 60s and 70s that aren't doing very well today and say, you know, what happens when the neighborhoods that were built in the 80s, 90s and early 2000s get to that age? They're going to be in much the same shape. Area wise, that's almost all your city. I mean, that's most of your city. And so I think the challenge becomes which of that stuff is viable? Where are the neighborhoods that are willing to adapt and evolve and change? And how do we create enough energy and vitality there? How do we change our codes and regulations, our public investment approach? How do we get stuff going in those places so they don't just fall apart?
And again, what you'd be emphasizing is sort of concentrating more people in smaller spaces. That's sort of what the direction is here.
I think I would say it a little bit differently. I think, you know, for me,
I wasn't artful enough. Yeah.
Well, no, I think the idea, well, let me point out two different ways, I think, to think about this, because the one I wholly reject, and that is this idea that through some kind of smart growth matrix, the government can come in and regulate a certain development pattern into existence. You know, you must all concentrate development here in this place along this node with this bus line, and that's how it's going to work. And we're going to build big apartments there and have huge amounts of change. I don't find that viable financially. I also don't find it culturally very viable. I think there are neighborhoods right now today in Kansas City where people would like to do more. Where they have a single family home and they're struggling to make the rent. And boy, wouldn't it be nice if we could rent out the lower level to another family. Mm-hmm. You can't do that today. I mean, that's not allowed. Those things are natural. Those are things that humans have done for literally thousands and thousands of years in cities. We need to make a lot of that stuff legal again. And if we can start to kind of free up the development pattern to adapt and grow and change, then what I think we'll see is successful places will emerge out of that. Places that, you know, where people are not forced to concentrate, but where people, I think, for mutual benefit want to concentrate. Why don't we allow that today? You know, we should. That's like a first step.
You know, I mentioned in the introduction that you like to talk about this neighborhood's first approach to development. Talk to me a little bit more about that and what you mean by that, Chuck.
Right now, when we talk about the government, particularly local governments, making strategic investments to create growth, we're generally talking about big kind of transformative projects. How do we get the huge new interchange? How do we build the big new splashy building? How do we do the big highway expansion? What we find is that, particularly in 2018, those are negative returning investments. Those are things that for every dollar we spend, we're getting 10 cents, 20 cents back on the dollar. When we look at our neighborhoods, particularly these places that we need to grow and evolve and change, smaller investments, investments that actually directly kind of respond to where people are struggling in neighborhoods, have a much lower risk, but a much higher return.
An simple example would like, be what? Yeah.
Oh, I was going to give you simple things like street trees, right? Street trees seem like beneath us. You know, why would a city go out and do street trees? Well, the simple answer is that for every street tree you plant at $50 or $75, you're getting hundreds of dollars of tax base appreciation. those things pay for themselves in a really short period of time. They make neighborhoods more valuable. They make properties more valuable. They provide shade for people walking. They provide a ton of benefit to a neighborhood. Why are we out doing that where they're needed? Things like making it easier to cross the street. Maybe that's a crosswalk. Maybe it's widening out the sidewalks a little bit. Maybe it's putting a bump out in. When people are trying to navigate from one neighborhood to another, we've figured it out on car. But really, getting people to travel one neighbor to another by automobile is, again, a very low returning investment. Getting them to be able to walk the two blocks to the neighborhood store, that has returns not only for that store and the property value there, but all of a sudden it improves the quality of life and the value of that home, that property. And that shows up directly on the balance sheet too. So what we found is that these small investments, when we focus on quality of life, really have huge financial returns.
Hey, and I gather you would suggest that Kansas City needs to focus more on this neighborhoods first approach you're talking about?
I think right now Kansas City is very much like most Midwestern cities, where our kind of internal bureaucracy, and I don't say that with negative connotations, just the way we conduct ourselves as governments is focused up the government food chain. You know, what kind of programs does the state have? What kind of programs does the federal government have? How do we tap into those and get the grants and the loans and the things we need to do big projects? And what I'm saying is we need to reorient those internal functions to really focus on our neighborhoods, our people, where individuals are struggling to do day-to-day things. And if we did that, it reveals just a limitless amount of investment we can make, investments that are really easy to do, but also really profitable for a city to undertake.
I want to go back to the other of your key ideas here, this notion that for 70 years or so, cities have failed to create enough revenue to fund their infrastructures. As a result, you know, so many streets, utilities, they're deteriorating out there, yet we keep building more. I think this applies to Kansas City. Where do you go to find solutions to that, Chuck?
Well, I think that's a tricky question. And I'm going to answer it in a way that probably is dissatisfying to you. Mm-hmm. What we tell people, what we try to help people understand is that problems have solutions, but predicaments have outcomes. I think if we went back, you know, to the 1950s and 60s and the first real time that some of these things started to fall apart and we had to go out and fix them and maintain them, had we at that point kind of reexamined where we were, said, oh, you know, maybe this isn't working quite the way we thought, then we had a problem where we had solutions. I mean, we could have retooled and done things differently, but that's not what we did. We borrowed a ton of money. You see public sector debt at the municipal level go from 2% of spending to now average of 16% nationwide. We've seen cities where 40% of their budget goes to pay debt on capital projects. Right. So we shifted our funding of local governments, you know, just like we shifted our macro economy from making investments that paid off to taking on debt as a way to kind of extend things out and make things work. At this point, we've got an unproductive development pattern, one that sucks up capital, not creates it, and we've got a ton of debt. There's no real solution to that problem. There's just a lot of nasty outcomes. Mm-hmm. The question we have is, like, how do we start to deal with that? I think an immediate response is we got to stop building stuff that's making us poorer. And I think that's, you know, when you think about 12-step programs, the first step is admitting you have a problem. I think one of the things we have to do is admit that this development pattern, it has negative returns. It makes us poorer the more we do it. And we actually need to stop doing it.
You know, that's really tough politically, though, because in cities like Kansas City, we tend to reward our mayors because they've done positive things for the city. They've built a new arena. They've built a new convention center. They've built a new downtown. I think, you know, here, to some degree, voters sort of expect it and even demand it of their leaders. So the change you're talking about, you know, maybe easier said than done.
Right. I think there's a certain bread and circuses aspect to it, right? You know, when you're planting street trees, you don't have ribbon cuttings and grand openings.
Right.
When you're doing the big building, you do, right? This is why, you know, the last time that I was there, we had over 600 people in attendance. Throughout this series, you've reached thousands and thousands of people in Kansas City. This is a long game. We're not trying to, through this initiative and this program, and by my coming back to town again, convince the politicians to do something different. We're actually looking for a deeper cultural shift in the conversation. We need people in Kansas City to actually say, we don't identify with that as success. Here's what we identify with success. And it looks much different. I'm hopeful that people will start asking for different things.
That's a huge paradigm shift.
It's a revolution. Yeah. And it is a paradigm shift. There's no doubt. We've not tasked ourselves with doing simple things, here. Yeah.
Where did you come up with your interest in the smart development of America's cities, Chuck? Where did that come from in your life?
I'm an engineer, and I did engineering work for years here in central Minnesota, in my hometown. And I really felt strongly that the work I was doing, which is very similar to the work that people done for decades in Kansas City, was making my city better off, making, you know, the place that I love much better. I got this sinking feeling after a while that maybe that wasn't the case. And it really took me going back and evaluating with a hard, you know, a sharp pencil and a hard nose, the financial ramifications of the projects that I had done personally as an engineer, to start to kind of question and develop this alternative kind of narrative about how you create success. And I started to share these ideas with people. I started to ask these questions more publicly. In 2008, I started to write a blog about this. You know, am I making my city bankrupt? Mm-hmm. And boy, it just took off from there. There were literally thousands of people who started to email me and write me and correspond and say, like, this is happening in my city too. What do we do? So Strong Towns is an organization, a movement to try to solve that problem.
Yeah, I was going to say Strong Towns is your site, and it's worth checking out. How receptive are leaders in Kansas City to what you're proposing here?
It's funny because I came to Kansas City for the first time, I want to say back in 2013, and was plugged into a very small group then, as our movement was very small at the time. And it did not go well. In fact, internally, we kind of made jokes about Kansas City for a long time as being, you know, the Sodom and Gomorrah, essentially, of our conversation, where we just, you know, went in and were wholly rejected and laughed at. That has changed in a big way. And we have tons of members there, lots and lots of readers. Like I said, we had over 600 people the last time I was there. And the leadership, I think, is starting to, if not wholly embrace this conversation, at least be thankful or respectful of the fact that it's going on and it's something that they need to tune into. I hope at the end of the day that we give public officials and professionals the breathing room to talk about these things and take actions that I think they know need to happen, but they lack the narrative to really talk about. Yeah. We're trying to create space for them to do good work.
Chuck Marone is the founder and president of Strong Towns, and I should point out that he'll be speaking at 6:30 Tuesday evening at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information about Chuck's appearance can be found at kclibrary.org. A lot more to be talked about. Chuck will be doing it on Tuesday night. Hey, thanks so much for taking some time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm very excited to come back. There's a lot of great stuff happening in Kansas City.
You bet. Coming up, Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list.
Listen for the best. My reputation's never been worse, so you must like me for me. We can't make any promises now, can we, babe? But you can make me dream. Dive bar on the east side, where you at? Phone lights at my nightstand in the black. Come here, you can meet. Look at you, oh damn, never seen that color blue. Just think of the fun things we could do. Cause I like you. Listen for the best. My reputation's never been worse, so you must like me for me.
Brian McTavish is here to talk about cool stuff to do on your weekend. And one thing that's going to be cool this weekend, that's Taylor Swift. She'll be here on Saturday night out at Arrowhead. And boy, that's a different sound than I'm used to hear from Taylor Swift.
Well, you say that would be one cool thing to do. Taylor Swift, it might be three or five or seven cool things to do all in one. As you are pointing out, who is that? Well, that's Taylor Swift. Well, here's the thing. She starts out at age 15 or 16 as an insta hit in the country music department.
Yeah, I was gonna say, right?
Now, she could have been, she could still be doing that, but no. She kind of slipstreamed into some other musical genres, right? She went the pop route, the rock route. She's even kind of touched base on the hip hop route. She hasn't done it all yet. Well, just give her time.
But it's working for her.
Oh my gosh, is it working for her? I mean, the pop princess herself, 7 o'clock Saturday, Arrowhead Stadium. She's on her Reputation, name of the last album, came out last year, I guess. Reputation, it's a stadium tour. So, I mean, she's so big now that she can just like make it happen for who knows how many fans. She reportedly shares one different surprise song with quotes, surprise, with fans at every tour stop.
Mm.
So, you know, she'll do 30 or 40 songs, and one of them will be different in every town. So all the teeny boppers will be hanging on the edge of their seats waiting to hear.
I like this song, though. It's a good song.
Oh, yeah. This is actually called Delicate, and she's ruminating about her reputation, her bad reputation. But Steve, no matter how iffy it can get, no matter how much crazy celebrity stuff is slung her way, the lyric in this song says, hey, we have fun together. I like you, right? I want to spend time with you. And that's her personal relationship, whether it be the boyfriend of the week or the lifetime fan who'll be coming to see her 30 years from now on that tour, which you and me will be talking about 30 years from now.
Taylor Swift, 7 o'clock Saturday night out at Arrowhead, right? Okay.
Yeah. Very entertaining. Very entertaining.
Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me cry? Precious kisses, what's that for me? Lovers never ask you why.
No, is that who I think it is?
That's who you think it is.
No kidding.
That's who you think it is.
And the boy George is going to be here.
Boy George himself, right, and Culture Club. Now, when he started out, it was just Culture Club in the early 80s on MTV.
But now.
Now,
it's
Boy George and Culture Club, and deservedly so.
Yes.
And they're on board with the B-52s and Tom Bailey, who was the guy who was the lead singer of the Thompson Twins back in those crazy 80s. The 80s are back. Did they ever leave? I'm not sure. 7 o'clock. I mean, they never really left, did they? 7 o'clock Friday at Starlight Theater. Let me see here. What wonderful songs will we hear? Well, we'll hear this one. Do you really want to hurt me?
I do not.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, how come... Yeah, what's great about you is your answers are the same on the air as well as off the air.
You think?
You know how to play the game.
Don't like violent movies. Don't like to hurt anybody. Okay, that's where I hang my hat.
No violence at Boy George and Culture Club at Starlight Theater. But, of course, you'll have the B-52s as well doing Rock Lobster, Love Shack, Rome, Deadbeat Club. Heck, I'd go just for the B-52s. I think some listeners might agree, although nothing against Boy George. Should be a wonderful evening. It'll be a real throwback bill. I sure wish MTV had survived as successfully as Culture Club, because you get all four original members of Culture Club.
Wow.
Not just Boy George, but the other three guys. And just for fun, let's name them. Guitarist, keyboardist Roy Hay, bass guitarist Mikey Craig, and drummer John Moss. Do you recognize any of those names?
I do not. Boy George. Be sure to see Brian's six authentic things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. My goodness, what do we have here? This is a different different tone.
Okay, here. Yes.
Yes.
We change it up occasionally here. Question, one lump or two, Steve?
Two.
Oh, really?
No, really. Probably none.
How about three for me?
Too old for lumps.
Do you put sugar?
Oil. No sugar.
Back to the violence. No.
Yeah.
No sugar in your tea.
No sugar in my tea.
Okay, no. I want all the cream and sugar I can get.
Yes.
And I will be wanting that at the Midwest Tea Festival, where high tea and all forms of levels of tea will be celebrated.
We have a Midwest Tea Festival.
We do.
That makes us a great city.
You know, I was listening on the drive in.
Yeah.
And you know what?
Interesting guy.
Interesting guy. I was interested in that, but guess what? We don't need to make Kansas City great again. Kansas City's already,
already great.
Just putting
and
my
the Midwest
two cents
Tea
in.
Festival
yes,
makes it great.
Yes, tea tastings, workshops, lectures, vendors aplenty for the so-called Tea Curious. 10 to 5 Saturday and Sunday, it returns to the Ararat Shrine Temple in KCMO. Don't miss the sip-in for peace with meditation on Saturday.
Really?
And, yes. Oh, yes, 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 yes.
I should laugh, but it's kind of
Experts
funny.
Experts in this department will be on hand, as well as an aging well with tea seminar on Sunday. You can live to be 150 if you drink the right tea.
All right.
I'm on a tangent, textbook ephemeral. Facts are confusing me. I'm so free now.
Hey. Now for an event right down your pike. What do we got here?
Are you feeling free?
Yeah, there you go.
Are you feeling easy?
The Free State Con.
Oh, this is actually Beck, who's coming to town in a couple of weeks, but we'll get to him later. But let's just groove on this Beck, I'm So Free.
Yes.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And we're playing it because it's the Free State Con. It's an old-fashioned comic book convention, old comic book show, which is to say...
And you're going to be there.
And I'm going to be there.
Yeah, I know you will be.
I'll be one of the old guys
with
there.
With all your buddies.
I'll be there with all the other old guys. Yeah, maybe a few kids smuggled in just to have some laughs with. Hey, it's a funny book. Look, it smells like newsprint. It's great. Remember that? There's no screen on it. Anyway, so what you do is you'll come to this thing on Saturday from 10 to 5. It's on the Douglas County Fairgrounds. You will feel totally free and easy with the comic book love. It's in Lawrence. Did I mention that? But you get more than 20 comic book vendors, and they'll have wonderful ephemera there relating to the characters. And you'll have more than 30 comic creators at the Free State Con.
Wow.
And a real quick mention, one of them is Kerry Callan, who's takeoffs on DC and Marvel superheroes have graced the first couple issues of the relaunched Mad Magazine. Great stuff, Kerry. Go meet Kerry Callan. Get your Mad Magazine autograph.
And finally today.
Finally.
Man, I hate the getting away of that song. The whole studio's rocking.
Okay, hold on a minute then. Why don't we listen just for 5 more seconds? 5, just 4,
bit, just bit. Go.
Oh! It's a tribute to Aretha Franklin. The queen is dead. Long live the queen.
And we should offer our tributes to her.
Well, we should. She passed away last week at age 76. 7 o'clock Friday, a tribute to Aretha Franklin at... Bayou on the Vine.
Wow.
That's at 18th and Vine. Look it up online. You've got a bunch of fantastic local singers laying into the thing, respecting the queen. Give them their props. Give them their props.
And that's Brian McTavish with your spectacular weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
That's right.
Tomorrow on the show, what to consider when looking for senior housing for you or an aging loved one. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.